Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict focuses at his general audience on ecology and the Christian's moral imperative to care for creation. And we hear from a leading Catholic campaigner on the need for an ecological conversion. He believes the Church should be in the forefront of the struggle to protect our natural environment. Protection of the environment and the safeguarding of creation for future generations were the themes at the heart of Pope Benedict's reflections during his general audience this Wednesday morning. The Pope was speaking to thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered in the courtyard of his summer residence at Castel Gandolfo. Veronica Scaresbrick has all the details.
Benedict XVI called on world leaders and all the faithful to exercise greater care for creation this Wednesday during his weekly general audience. The Pope's remarks came ahead of a United Nations conference on climate change scheduled for later this year in Copenhagen, Denmark. The Holy Father insisted the summer holidays have given us all the opportunity to thank God for the precious gift of creation. He then went on to reflect upon the relationship between the Creator and ourselves as guardians of His creation.
The earth is indeed a precious gift of the Creator, who in designing its intrinsic order has given us guidelines that assist us as stewards of His creation. Precisely from within this framework, the Church considers that matters concerning the environment and its protection are intimately linked with integral human development.
In his recent encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, the Pope spoke of the pressing moral need for renewed solidarity, not only among countries but also among individuals. The natural environment is given by God to everyone, said the Pope, so our use of it entails a personal responsibility towards humanity as a whole, particularly towards the poor and towards future generations.
How important it is, then, that the international community and individual governments send the right signals to their citizens and succeed in countering harmful ways of treating the environment. The economic and social costs of using up shared resources must be recognized with transparency and borne by those who incur them, and not by other peoples or future generations. The protection of the environment and the safeguarding of resources and of the climate oblige all leaders to act jointly, respecting the law and promoting solidarity with the weakest regions of the world.
Indeed, we are all called to exercise responsible stewardship of creation, Pope Benedict insisted, to use resources in such a way that every individual and community can live with dignity and develop that covenant between human beings and the environment, which should mirror the creative love of God. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
Ecology and the protection of the environment have become increasingly important issues for the Church over recent years. The connection between peace and the care of creation will be at the heart of Pope Benedict's message for the next World Peace Day, to be celebrated on January 1, 2010. The document is likely to echo sections of Benedict's recent encyclical, Veritas in Caritate, as well as Pope John Paul II's 1990 World Peace Day message, entitled Peace with God the Creator, Peace with All of Creation, one of the first wake-up calls for Catholics about the pressing and far-reaching implications of environmental problems. Just a few years earlier, the World Council of Churches had also highlighted what it called the integrity of creation as one of its priorities. And since then, Christian churches around the world have increasingly been including ecology as an integral part of their justice and peace programs and actions. In many countries, men and women religious have been in the forefront of this work, publishing pamphlets, promoting seminars, or organising prayer services to encourage others to get involved. Whether it's on climate change, biodiversity, water or energy resources, they say it's essential to act now to try and reverse the damaging effects of our overconsumption, waste and pollution on the Earth's natural resources. One Irish priest who has dedicated a large part of his life to this mission is Columban Father Sean McDonough, a well-known author and tireless campaigner on the threats of climate change. He was here in Rome recently after attending a conference in Assisi aimed at encouraging other religious orders and organisations to put greater emphasis on these ecological issues. I sat down with Father Sean to find out more about his concerns and why he believes the church should be leading the way when it comes to environmental protection.
I'm a missionary myself. I went to the Philippines in 1969. I studied anthropology and eventually I began to work with a tribal group of people called the Tiboli in the southern part of the Philippines. Now, I'd been very sensitive to justice issues because I worked under a dictatorship, to peace issues because people gave their lives for peace or for the cause of others. But I hadn't been very sensitive to what was happening to the natural world until I went among the Tiboli. And there I saw this extraordinary beautiful forest, the dipterocarp forest of Southeast Asia, just being laid to waste. One year you'd walk through it and it had extraordinary biodiversity, like 130 or 40 different species of trees to every hectare. My own country, Ireland, has only 10 species of trees in the whole country. The next month you'd walk through, or the next year, it would be like a moonscape. So I became very, very sensitive to, look, the church has a very good voice on social justice, right from the 19th century, 20th century, all the various social encyclicals. It has a very good voice on peace, Pacem in Terris, the homilies of Pope John Paul, and before that, Pius XII during World War II. But we were saying nothing on the destruction of God's creation. So it was there I became aware that this must be at the heart of mission. And for the last 30 years, I've been promoting this concern for God's creation, remembrance of God's creation, thanksgiving for God's creation, and care of God's creation at the heart of what it means to be a Christian.
It's true to say that the church over these past 30 years has made huge strides, hasn't it, and is now very concerned about the environment. Is that fair to say or not?
I don't think so. No, I think we'd be exaggerating if we did. And you get a very good focus on it in terms of the Compendium of the Social Teachings of the Church, which was just published in 2004. Most of it is excellent in traditional areas of Catholic social teaching. When it comes to Chapter 10, which is on the environment, I'd have to say it's quite poor. And it's not always even consistent. I mean, the best probably statement of all was by Pope John Paul II in January 2001, where he called for an ecological conversion, not just for Christians, but for all the peoples of the world. Now, that isn't even in that compendium of the social teachings of the Church. So we need a very radical take, I think, based on our Christian Catholic teaching that God created the world, God continues to create the world. We believe in the incarnation, that God became part of the world. He could not have become flesh if he wasn't part of the totality of what it means to be human, which is connected with every other species and connected with the air and the water and the soils that support us. And finally, we believe in a sacramental theology that the most intimate experience of God is not in our heads or not in nice ideas. It is actually in bread and wine. It's in oil and it's in water. In other words, in the realities of the natural world. I believe the Catholic Church should be out there leading in this area, and we should be connecting every one of our liturgies. We should be connecting, for example, baptism with the condition of water in the world. One of the big concerns of people all over the world, and I see this daily almost, is a concern for fresh potable water. Will it be there in the future? So here's a real concern. We could connect it. Does anyone ever say, let me check the water of baptism, you know? Does it have contaminants in it? It's supposed to be the water of life, but maybe it has contaminants. And I think that would be a very good education for people in a particular area. We've checked the water that we baptise you with every Saturday or Sunday, and we find it's deficient. Why is that? Should it be like that? And what can we do about it?
this theology of creation, spirituality of creation, why is this not permeating the church more at a broader level?
Well, I suppose it is beginning to permeate, but we had been very focused just on the history of salvation. And we've forgotten that this extraordinary universe is 13.7 billion years old. We've been looking on the last word of the last page of 30 volumes. I think we're beginning to move, but we're beginning to move slowly. The problem is the realities we face mean we must move much more quickly. Water is one of them. Another area is, I spoke at that conference on climate change. We don't have forever, unfortunately. We have about 15 to 20 years window of opportunity to keep the added temperature below 2 degrees Celsius by, in a sense, limiting greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. So we have 15 years to do that. Again, I think the Catholic Church should be out there leading this particular process in a moral sense, saying, look, you have a moral obligation to the poor of the world who will suffer most right now, peoples of Bangladesh, 30 million of them live in an area just 1 meter above the high water mark. Where will that 30 million people go if the sea level rises, even 1 meter? So not just people living now, but every single future generation, we have a moral responsibility to them. And to be fair, in John Paul's document of 1990, Peace with God the Creator, Peace with All Creation, he does call the ecology a moral and a religious issue, and does actually highlight the importance of climate change in that. But it seems like often just a once-off. What I'd like to see is a much more consistent and integrated teaching across our liturgy, across our systematic theology, and particularly in our moral area. We haven't yet understood that actually destroying God's creation is as much a sin as offending our neighbour or actually offending God. They're all part of what it means to live a Christian life today.
Where are you looking for this leadership? Is it the Pope? Is it the bishops who have to lead? Or should this be coming from the grassroots? Is it coming from the grassroots?
Well, I say both. I think if you wanted to ask me where is it most evident in the Catholic Church, in my experience now, it's in congregations of religious women. They are the ones who have done the best analysis. They are the people also trying to live in alternative ways, kind of finding out how we can live in a way that doesn't destroy the natural world. So it's happening there. It's beginning to happen among missionary congregations and among religious congregations. That's why we had this seminar in Assisi, and no better place than in Assisi, where you had this extraordinary individual in the 13th century, St. Francis, who was concerned, yes, about the leper, and kissed the leper, but also preached the gospel to the birds. In other words, had no problem that all of creation was part of the family, part of the kin. In many senses, since the Reformation, we have always been saying, well, just Homo sapiens, just mankind, we're not that terribly worried about what happens to other species as long as humans are okay. Francis was quite different. Everyone was part of the brotherhood and the sisterhood. And I think that's, of course, that's now underpinned by the best of science, of ecology and biology, and understanding that we've all come from, historically, an evolution from a single reality of life. So we are actually literally connected to the stones and to every other creature as part in the universe, and particularly in this planet. We now, through our technology, have the ability either to see the whole thing going forward in an extraordinary way, a way that will give life to us and all future generations, or we have the possibility of destroying one third or one half of it. That's another area. I wrote a book many years ago on the death of life. And surely the Catholic Church, which is very pro-life, should be taking seriously the fact that we're now living amid the sixth largest extinction of life since life happened. Life began about 3.7 billion years ago. The last thing of this magnitude happened with the wiping out of the dinosaur about 62 to 63 million years ago. It was a meteor that came from space and impacted the Earth in such a way that photosynthesis was stopped or was interfered with, and those great creatures died. Now it's just humankind. We are basically saying every space on the planet, in the air, on the Earth and in the sea, is just there for us, for mankind. And we're often very masculine in that we don't include women. And I think we just have to get a new understanding of our place in the natural world. And I think a good theology of incarnation, of understanding who Jesus was, would help us. And that was one of the one of the great talks at that week we had in Assisi. And I think as Christians, of course, we have to underpin our engagement with these areas and link it to our foundational faith, which is we believe that the God of love sent his Son for the life of the world in John 3, and now is calling us to be stewards in the very best sense, and understanding that this is the call of what it means to be a Christian in the 21st century.
To bring about this kind of radical change, perhaps you're saying, in the church's thinking, you're going to need a lot of training in the seminaries, in all areas of religious life and ministry.
That's very true, you do. And I think the part of that is beginning, but not enough. I mean, I offer myself in Ireland part-time master's degree in ecology and religion, where we bring together the best of modern ecology in terms of science or religion with also a deep understanding of faith across Christology, the Eucharist, for example, baptism. All of the sacraments are open to this new understanding because, as I say, it is through the natural world that we have the deepest experience of the divine in our lives. A lot of good work has been written on this in the last 30 years. I was one of the first authors in this area way back in the early 1980s with The Care for the Earth. At that time, it was a single volume. It took me 3 years to get it published. No one would publish it. So nowadays, you can walk into a creation library and they're stacked from the bottom up to the ceiling. What needs to happen more, and I think it is happening in grade school and high school with the religious education programmes. It hasn't worked its way yet into the seminaries. And one area I'd love to see it working its way into is particularly into liturgy and particularly into the Eucharist. That here we are, basically, what have we in the Eucharist? We have bread and wine. In a sense, it is the ideal of the ecological concern. It's not just wheat or grape juice. It is the fruitfulness of the earth and through God's blessing, but also the work of human hands. And in a sense, that should become a model for us. Here each Sunday, we're offering bread and wine, which is the fruit of the earth and work of human hands. And I think it should be a challenge to us. How do we live? How am I going to live my life this week? Am I going to be a predator on the natural world? Or am I going to, in a sense, be fruit of the earth and work of human hands? In other words, working in a mutually enhancing way with humankind and the rest of creation. Also in the Eucharist, we give thanks to God every Sunday, not just for salvation in Christ, but for the wonder of creation. And it would be lovely sometimes of a Sunday morning if the intimacy of that was worked out with the local community. For example, if you're living on the side of a river, it's very different from if you're living in the polar regions. And that we could incorporate something of that into our Eucharistic prayers so that people will realise their concern for the earth and their offering of the Sunday Eucharist is part of the same reality. I suppose one of the saddest things in my own experience is when I came back to Ireland in the mid to late 1990s, I live close to the biggest river in the country, which is the Shannon. And I live close by a lake which was being interfered by various pollutants and eutrophication and all of that. Many of the people involved in trying to protect the lake were actually Catholic Christians. But they've made no connection between their concern for this lake and their Sunday morning Eucharist. And it was a big revelation to them. And I said, well, this is what we do at Eucharist. We thank God for creation around us. We want to see the wonder and beauty of this lake that we have experienced as young people passed on to future generations. And that was it. So it's that kind of connect. And that's what religion does, you see. Religion comes from the Latin word religio. We make connections. And I'd like to see more and more connections made in theology, in spirituality, in liturgy, with the world, the natural world around us. For example, one of the reasons I'm critical of GMOs is because most of it now is being fed to animals. So what's happening is the European and North American diet, very heavy in meat, is actually being generalized around the world. The planet simply cannot afford that. Studies done in Yale University in the United States says that the planet could probably support 9 billion people on the kind of diet, meat diet, that people in Asia have, which is meat is a very small part of their daily food. If we move into a European diet, it will support about 1.2 million people, a billion people. Now, here I think the church could say, look, traditionally we said meet on a Friday because it reminded us of the passion, death and resurrection of Christ. But now we're holding out to you for the fruitfulness and the survival of many species on the planet and for the well-being of the poor of the planet. We would suggest to you that meat be a much lesser part of your diet. Maybe 3 days a week we would seek vegetables rather than actually engaged in a meat diet. Now, obviously, that would be different in different parts of the world. But I think there we would be engaging the real concerns of the planet and then bringing our experience of religion and our challenges to address that particular issue.
Let's look at this concern of genetically modified foods. It's something that you're very concerned about, isn't it? Particularly about, as you see it, the failure of the church to really focus on the moral and ethical implications of these new technologies.
Well, that's right. And I would approach it as a missionary myself, rather than I'm not a geneticist and I'm not a biotechnologist. So I have seen, for example, in the Philippines, in the area I worked in, South Cotabato, the BT corn was planted there, very much against the wishes of local people and also the wishes of the local church. Bishop Dinoaldo Gutierrez has, and in general, the Philippine hierarchy have been very strong on that. There are a number of reasons. First of all, it's been promoted by a transnational corporation that doesn't have a great track record in the United States or in Asia. That's Monsanto. And we'd be very concerned about that maybe 5 or 6 transnational corporations around the world would get control of the staple foods of the world, the seeds of the staple foods of the world. Now, that might seem completely impossible, but don't forget the staple foods of the world are down to about 15 or 20, and particularly 5, rice, maize, wheat, potatoes, and maybe one of the other cereals. So traditionally, there was real concern if people had a monopoly of even a technological instrument. For 5 or 6 companies to have a monopoly of food is seriously problematic. So that's one of my areas. The second area is this, that the technology itself is being promoted by the companies. They're the ones doing the research in it. There's no independent research to verify, for example, whether it is safe for humankind. Don't forget, you have to fool the target organism, that what you're bringing across genetically is part of its own genetic makeup. Otherwise, its immune system would attack it. That's what our immune systems are there for. Now, to do something like that and not to test it rigorously, particularly because it is a living organism and can generate and mutate, I think is a serious issue. And I would like to see that done by independent agencies, not just by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, or the EPA, looking at the construct which the company gives them and saying, well, that seems to be all right for us. I'd like to see independent research to assure us, yes, that it isn't going to be a problem for humankind, health-wise or in terms of the rest of creation.
As you know, though, the proponents argue that genetic modification goes on naturally all the time in nature. They're simply harnessing this possibility, this potential, in order to really make a difference, to answer, if you like, the Pope's call to combat the scourge of hunger.
Well, the first thing is not true. To use a technical term, recombinant DNA technology doesn't happen in nature. You will not get, for example, wheat breeding with cattle, for example. You won't take the genetic material for wheat and put it into cattle. Or you won't take the genetic material from a flounder fish and put it into a tomato. So that's actually what's involved in genetically engineered products. And one of them was actually the Flavor Saver tomato, where to give it time on the shelves of shops, they genetically engineered a gene from the flounder fish that slowed down the spoiling of this particular object. So that doesn't happen in nature at all in terms of moving across genetic material. Secondly, I feel that there's been numerous studies. There was a wonderful study last year published in April by the Association of Technological People Involved in Agriculture. It was a 4-year study. It involved about 400 scientists from something like 80 countries in the world. And in the World Bank was involved in it. The United Nations was involved. And it said the way forward in terms of food security is not a single bullet like genetically engineered food. In actual fact, it is diverse agriculture and that we promote the ability of farmers to do that, for example, that we make credit available to them, that we make the kind of proper tools available to them, that we actually do improve the seeds. Science is absolutely essential for good organic agriculture, and I'm involved with groups in the Philippines, Masipag, who are doing exactly that. You have scientists, farmers, and also shopkeepers involved in improving the quality of rice. But it's based on the farmer and the consumer, not on patenting organisms which will give a huge benefit to the biotech companies. So some of those other questions in terms of, for example, a recent study done by the Union of Concerned Scientists in the United States called Failure to Yield. It made it very clear that the increase in yield across the board of the crops that have been genetically engineered was not due to genetic engineering, but actually due to very good conventional, traditional forms of breeding. And I think that's very important. So the arguments they make, I do not see any empirical evidence. These are claims, but the empirical evidence that I have seen has been in the opposite direction. The huge issue I have with it morally is, of course, this patenting. I mean, I don't think any living organism should be patented. It didn't happen until the 1980s. It was a Supreme Court decision in 1980 in the United States, Diamond versus Chakravarti, that allowed this person and General Electric to patent an enzyme at the time. Now, even then, the court did not want it to move beyond that. Within 5 years, it had patented a complete mammal, a mouse, the Onco mouse, and now you can patent even human gene lines. So I think it's like, to me, patenting life is like slavery. There's no good form of slavery. I mean, masters can be very bad to slaves, but the reality of slavery itself, I think, is immoral, as I do think it is in terms of genetically engineered organisms which are patented. I think the church, again, a pro-life church, should seriously address that particular issue. There are other ways to remunerate people for the time, energy and money they have put into working on these particular crops. I have no problem with that. But to use the patenting mechanism, I think, is very problematic. And when you look at the history of patenting, for example, every single country that developed, including the United States, including the modern ones like Korea and Japan, most of them took ideas from other cultures. For example, in the 1820s, United States people from Pittsburgh went over to Britain, saw what they were doing in terms of the cotton and linen industry, brought it back to Pittsburgh and reproduced them there. And there's a very good book written by a Cambridge economist, Hwa Jung Shang, he's Korean, making that very point. He said, and he calls it kicking away the ladder. This is how all of you people actually developed an affluent society, and now you're saying we cannot do it. So he said, why is that? Why have we to go another particular route? But certainly medicine, and particularly living organisms, food, I think the church should take a very strong position against that.
And my thanks there to Columban missionary father Sean McDonough. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.